everybody, and you're very welcome back to another episode of F&I Rap Chat. We're really excited to have a filmmaker whose work I've been watching for a while, since her first shorts, Mea Culpa, most notably, and her journey into feature filmmaking. It has been really interesting, one watching from a distance. And we're chatting today about a film which I found of huge interest for a couple of different reasons. It's you may or may not be familiar with Virginia's work, but and she's now on to her second feature, which is of huge interest to me. I find it a brilliant,
And I mean this.
slow burning drama about grief and couples and relationships between fathers and daughters and mothers and daughters and the family unit and exploring loss and grief and pain and hardship and all of those wonderful things
It's a
within an
comedy.
hour. It's a comedy, yes. Nice light comedy. How are you doing, Virginia? Very welcome to Rap
I'm
Chat.
good, thanks. Thank you, Paul. Sorry, I didn't mean to. How could I interrupt such a flow of gorgeous, generous praise? Thank you. I didn't realize you'd seen the early shorts. Yeah, Mea Culpa was my second one, actually. My first
Sorry.
one was called Hesitation. Which was, I think, probably the most fun I've ever had making a film because I knew absolutely nothing and was completely convinced I knew everything and therefore just sort of threw myself into it. And I don't think you ever have an experience like that again as a filmmaker. I found that the more I do, the more terrifying it becomes, weirdly. I was talking about it with my cinematographer, you know, that kind of complete carefree, just going for it, you only get it once, you know.
I mean, the more you know about, I suppose, how the sausage is made, there's more at stake, I
I think
suppose.
the more you realize you don't know, to be honest, and what is out of reach to you, or the gap between your ambition and what you're able to achieve, or and just I guess you're just older and wiser, sadly, in so many ways, isn't
And that's one thing we often talk about with people that come on, with people that come on the show, about the idea of imposter syndrome and not feeling as if you can actually pull it off. But then you do reach your Everest
it?
eventually. I suppose I'll start in relation to the film. Can you give us like a slight elevator pitch for the film, how it came about? Obviously, you wrote this as well, so.
So Reawakening is the story of John and Mary, played by Jared Harris and Juliet Stevenson, who are a sort of late middle-aged couple who, when we meet them, have been sort of trapped in an agony of limbo, of grief and uncertainty and so on, because 10 years ago their only child, a 14-year-old daughter called Claire, ran away from home and no trace of her has ever been found. So when we meet them at the beginning of the story, they have lived without any news or sense of what's happened to her for a decade. And one day, John, Jared Harris comes home from work. He's an electrician and comes home, and his wife Mary rushes out to greet him, very high key, and she says, "She's here. She's come home." And John is absolutely overwhelmed. Mary leads him to the kitchen. There's a young woman standing there, played by Erin Doherty. And Mary knows that it's their daughter, and John doesn't believe that it is. And so the story starts from there. And when we were doing the rounds with it, I always used to pitch it to people as it's basically a study of grief masquerading as a psychological thriller, because it is sort of, you know, you. Yes, of course, it's a drama. All films are drama, really, because all interactions between people are dramatic. But the motor of the story has a sort of thriller element to it, and it is quite, I think, quite a satisfying motor in that sense. But obviously, that's just a tool to get us to what we want to explore, which is, yes, the way we deal with grief, the sort of these very big existential questions, really, I guess, love and loss and the landscape of life after loss, and how we all have to face it, I guess.
I think we touched privately when we were having a chat about how it's fascinating to explore the lengths people go to in terms of self-delusion in their lives in order to get through the day, how to find some sort of peace, to some smaller or greater magnitudes. But it's a really interesting character study in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, self-delusion's one way of describing it. Juliet has often described it in Q and A's as, self-delusion has an element of judgment to it, I suppose. And she would always say that it's about what we need to believe in order to survive. And I think that's true of everybody, and that can be true in so many different ways, whether it's a religious faith, or a faith in your profession, or a faith in the bonds of your family, or a faith, there's a million things that people put their trust in and put their belief in. And yes, the film does explore elements of that, and I think in quite a complex but quite a human way, what people need to believe.
I found it to be, in the best possible sense of the word, a and I mean this constructively, a kind of top shelf movie, like the type of movie that you pick up in Laser and it catch your attention in a positive capacity. You'd leave with that movie as well. It would hook you. It's one of those movies that, if you were fortunate enough to come across it in a rental store, you pick it up and you love it. Or if it was, on BBC Two late at night. And it's the type of film that you would like and recommend and pass on to other people in a positive way. So it's,
Thank
an
you.
old style thriller, dramatic thriller that there's just not enough of anymore, that, is not dumbed down, and it's there to discover and unfold and sit, and it compels you to watch, as opposed to, with these type Netflix type algorithm-esque dramas where you can see where everything is coming down the line. This film is very much about the characters' journeys, as opposed to tying everything up in a nice little bow, and I found that quite refreshing in a very, very positive way,
Thank you so much. Well, I mean, it's incredibly kind of you. That's very much music to my ears, because that is really the life that I would wish for this film, which is that it does. It's word of mouth that builds. It's the sort of thing, yes, that you hope someone's going to catch late night on television, or take a chance on when they're scrolling through what's new on Amazon, what's new, and all that kind of stuff. And I must say, I think the quality of the performances in the film, what Jared, Juliet, and Erin brought, and their intense love and commitment to the material. I mean, I think it really, look, they didn't come on because we were paying them big bucks, and they didn't come on because they needed to do it for their careers, and they didn't come on because it was going to, revolutionize the way we see them. They absolutely fell in love with it, and I think that has made it into a very special piece. It's because I think, as you very kindly say, there's something deeply human about it, and compelling, because it is very much, I hope, and that was very much what was in my mind when I was writing it, is what the hell would I do in this situation? What am I going to do next? What's he going to do next that is both plausible, doesn't leave any plot holes, doesn't leave the audience going, "Oh, for God's sake," as you say, with a lot of fodder that's out there. It's like in bloody horror movies where, "Oh, I'm just going to go down to the basement, the really dark basement with no light, and I'm going to leave my phone up here," and you're just like, "Oh, come on, that's too easy." And I didn't want it to be easy. I wanted at every stage that each character had, was given their dues by me as a writer, so that no questions left unanswered, unasked, no plausible, rational, logical, "Well, I can ask for a DNA test then if you don't believe," or that kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? It's all in there. So, and I hope that is satisfying on a both a story level, a sheer sort of story level, but also then allows the characters to go to the places that we take them to, which are quite extreme in some ways. And you understand them. The more that I write, the more that actually the devil's in the details, and it makes a massive impact in terms of your story. And I, if I occasionally tutor or mentor, filmmakers at film school or writers and so on, I'm really, really, really ferocious about being totally plausible and thinking about the absolute nuts and bolts details of the circumstances of your characters' lives, the way, what do people do in their ordinary everyday? Because actually, those details do create your plot, and they do, the chance encounter at Tesco's, because everybody has to go to Tesco. Do you know what I mean? Is what's going to make it feel not only totally authentic, but that is the stuff of plotting too. It's not the the implausible leaps of psychology or contriving something because you need to fill a plot hole. Going right down into the depths. And in that way, I've learned, or I've begun to feel more and more, that writing is a lot closer to acting, because that's what actors do. They're always mining the details for the authenticity and for the behavior. And ultimately, all that we're trying to do as dramatists in every sense is to turn psychology into behavior. And all the details help you with that. The way somebody picks up a plate, whether or not they abandon the washing up for the night, those can actually have that can that kind of behavior has huge psychological revelation, depending on the context, of course. Sorry, that was a bit of a tangent, but yeah, it was a sort of.
No, absolutely. It segues nicely to my next question about how, from a creative writing perspective, how do ideas come? How do they come for you? How do you write? How does that work for you? Stuff
Well, I
for
mean, the ideas question, I wish I bloody knew, because I'd be a millionaire. I'd bottle it and then I'd do it every week, I mean, generally speaking, my best ideas have come when I'm not actively not thinking of ideas. So they've either come when I'm on holiday and I'm spending time reading other people's work and lounging by the pool and observing life going on around me. So the holidays have generated quite a few ideas. Often when I'm out walking, I do. I'm a big walker. Take long, long walks every day, which is sort of my thinking time and just getting out of my head time. So it's more often than not like that. And if I'm involved in if I'm in the middle of a project, the walks become absolutely vital because that is where things will pop up and a little solution might present itself or a new direction or something like that. But in terms of the actual getting stuff written, it's the sitting down every single day and doing it. There's no magic, unfortunately. I set myself a page count or a word count, depending on what I'm working on. And for me, that's the only way I can do it is self-imposed word counts or page counts a day. I have to get it done no matter what.
Self-imposed exile. I mean, I was chatting to Roddy Doyle once, and he told me that I asked him a similar question. How do you write? And he says, I just write. He said, kids have to be dropped to school.
That's right.
Things happen. He said, but I get up. He said, sometimes I get up at 6 a.m. I try and get an hour or two in, and I do it. I get it down. And he said, writing for him was about reducing distractions. So you create times for yourselves where there's the least amount of interactions, notifications online or television or things you like to watch, and you find that hour,
And it doesn't, actually, again, the more I've gone, it's not like I'm writing 12 hours a day. I think actually good quality writing, you're probably lucky if you get 4 hours of good quality writing a day max. But rewriting is slightly different. Rewriting can be a good solid 8, 9 hour working day, unfortunately. But yeah, the distraction thing, that's a huge thing. That's a huge thing. And also getting to know your own rhythm as a writer, which is distinct from discipline. You need the discipline. There's no getting away from it. I'm not a believer in you sit around and wait for the muse or I'm not feeling it today or whatever. You do grind it out, even if it's shit. You can always rewrite it, but you do have to hit your target. But it's more, I remember 8 years ago when I was starting out and I was seeing a therapist at the time. Not in the romantic sense. I was actually seeing them for genuine, legitimate mental health reasons. But I was describing to her how I talk about imposter syndrome. I was like, well, I can't be a writer because it's just ridiculous the way I work because I'll sit down, I'll write literally for 10 minutes, then I'll have to get up and put the kettle on or something. And then I'll sit back down and do a bit more. But literally, and she sort of heard me out, and I was doing this whole spiel about how that's not what proper writers do. They sit down solidly for hours. And she was like, well, this sounds like you're quite energetic, and that's just the way you need to do it. And I know it sounds incredibly simplistic, but that really unlocked something for me because I was like, oh, okay, that's allowed, actually. That's just, I'm just a fidgeter, or I need to, stand up every 10 minutes or whatever it may be. And I think there's an element of that as well. Some people may need to zone out for an hour before they get into it, or they might need to do that halfway through the process, or maybe they are somebody who can deal with a lot of stimulation and that's okay for them. And it's just giving yourself permission. As long as you're getting it done, you have permission to do it the way you need to do it, you know, whether that's a magic time of day for you or whatever. But I've written everywhere. I've written in any, honestly, I've written in any circumstance. I'm not particularly location dependent. I can write in coffee shops. I can write on the tube. I can write in, you know, sitting on a park bench. I've written, you know, ostensibly watching my daughter play football. I've written, you know, there's honestly, it doesn't matter to me where I am particularly. It's just as long as I'm hitting my target.
I suppose it's like actors in that regard. You know, how do actors learn lines? You know, there is no. Sometimes it goes straight in. It's the easiest thing in the whole world. And the next time it's a bit of a struggle for it to calibrate.
Some people have to listen to voice recordings of themselves for hours on end. Other people have to write it out. Other people, you know, or cramming for an exam. How did we do that back in the days when we had to do that?
Yeah, I still have nightmares about learning stuff for the.
So do I. That's my recurring nightmare. That is my recurring panic dream that I will often have before a production. Is that my dream is that I come out of my final A level exam, and you know that feeling when you come out of an exam and you've held everything in your head for so long, and then you have that relief of you can just let it all go. I don't need this stuff anymore. So that's the feeling that my dream begins with. And then as I'm literally stepping out of the room and have let everything go, the deputy head comes around the corner and says, oh, you do realize that wasn't the exam, that was just a mock, and you've got to do it all again in 3 months' time. and I can feel, even as I'm recounting it, the dread in the pit of my stomach of going, oh, fuck. And in a way, I feel a little bit that way with the filmmaking process. A little bit, with a lot more joy and excitement. But it is that sense of, oh God, there's this juggernaut of unbelievable uncertainty, and there's so much that is going to go wrong, obviously, and things that I can't even predict, and crises that are going to be impacting on every facet of my life and personality. And yet somehow, and so there's that dread of it, you're still going to push that, you know, juggernaut on.
Yeah, it's the pushing the boulder uphill thing, isn't it? And it's only through experience I think we realize that, you know, it's never as bad as we make it out to be in our minds through anxiety.
Right.
It's never as bad as we think it's going to be. In fact, it's a lot better than we could ever conceive, you know.
Yes.
I just talked to you very quickly about casting. I mean, some incredible talent there. Aaron Doherty's absolutely flying at the moment as well. But in terms of formulating a cast for something like this, how do you go about casting?
Well, I mean, there's two things. First of all, you just have your wish list of actors, which is often a ridiculous list. And in any normal circumstance, you wouldn't get them. But you have a slight advantage when you're an incredibly low budget film in that the difference in fee that you're going to pay, you know, you're offering no money, basically. And even if your budget were doubled or tripled or quadrupled, the fee is going to be negligible to bigger actors. So the one thing you have in your advantage is it's never going to be about the money. Therefore, if the script is of high quality and a casting director goes, ooh, that, you know, no, I think this could be of real interest, you can aim incredibly high, because you're ultimately going to be able to get lucky, hopefully, with a named quality actor who, you know, has a window or would really like to do something like this, is going to do it for the love of it, you know. So in that sense, the casting process is, you can kind of act the mogul, because you're going out to really big names sometimes, as a studio boss would, only what you don't have is the $50 million paycheck. The only thing you have is the quality. But that, with certain actors, is going to be just as good a calling card. So in that sense, we did aim very high. You know, Jared was absolutely top of my list, and we were just blessed that after initially him not being available for our dates, and we had to rethink, and I went off and cast the women, and, you know, that was a big deal, who was going to play John. We heard not officially via his agent, but via somebody who worked in the costume department on Foundation, that dates had shifted, blah blah blah. Suddenly he was going to be available for our dates. So, you know, it was a little bit of luck, and a fair and fair wind and so on, and then he fell in love with the script. So that's kind of how it went.
And what about Juliette Stevenson? I think I mentioned quickly to you before that I've had a crush on her since Truly Madly Deeply. How do you go about the good fortune of casting or working with, collaborating with somebody like that?
Well, she is just a true legend in every sense. I know that word is desperately overused, but she's the most magnificent person. Well, funnily enough, I'd known Juliet because when I well, known, I she had been attached to the very first feature I'd ever written. So when I'd made my first short that did quite well, that got me my first option on a feature project, which has never seen the light of day, actually never got made. That was with Element Pictures. I will always be beholden to them because they gave me my first proper deal. And off the back of that, I was able to get an agent and so on. Anyway, this particular project, which I love, I offered to Juliet, and I'd never met her before. As like you had grown, you know, sort of grown up with her and just loved her in every possible way. There are some actors, I think Jared is one of them as well, and Juliet, where I don't care what it is. If I see that they're involved in something, I'll watch it because I know they're going to do something interesting and they do quality and, you know. Anyway, so she'd been attached. So I'd met her years ago, and she'd come on board this project, and then we discovered that my mother had taught her daughter English. My mother was a teacher. So we had this whole other connection. She put two and two together. She said, "You, it's so weird because we've got this famous Mrs. Gilbert in our house, who is this brilliant English teacher who changed my daughter's life." And we put two and two together and realized it was my mum. So there was that lovely connection. Anyway, the movie, that original, long story short, that original movie never happened. We stayed in touch. You know, I would go and see her on stage, and you know, we weren't close friends or anything, but we kept the connection. And she was my absolute first choice for this, so I just sent her the script, and she, yeah, read it within 24 hours, and rang and said, "I'm absolutely going to do it." So that was
It
that,
is
really.
possible. So it is possible to get these people, you know, it is possible.
Oh, it is. I mean, look, I'd had the advantage that she'd loved a previous project of mine and had wanted to do it, and so, you know, she was going to be responsive to something I sent her because unless my writing ability had catastrophically declined in the last, you know, 8, 9 years or longer. She was going to have a look, so that was an advantage. But it also goes to show, without wanting to be, I suppose, woo-woo, but there are seasons for things, and these kinds of things will come around, and it's why the relationships are so important. You know, I used to be slightly more dismissive of that and think, well, if I'm not getting a gig off this person now, then it's not, you know. Whereas in fact, I'm now working with somebody that I've known more, that I was first introduced to when I was 18, have known and kept in touch with over the years, and have never worked with before, although it's always been, and now seems to be the moment, you know, 20 something years later.
It like collaboration and community is so important, isn't it? Because genuinely, I've met people, as you say, years and years ago, who things have swung back around, and genuinely, they've as an actor, that's an actor's life, you know, where a director or a producer might say to you, I really want to work with you, and you don't necessarily believe it, but it has come back around. I mean, it is about cultivating those creative relationships and being patient. Because if somebody does like you, or if somebody does believe in you, it will come around if they get the opportunity, if they say that, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'd say patience is the biggest key to success in our business, patience and resilience, you know.
Would you have a piece of advice you'd give yourself starting out,
Yeah, it would be
you
that. It would be patient, because
know?
that if, you know, if we're being Shakespearean about it, that is my fatal flaw. I'm the most one of the most impatient people I know, and that has I've I would say that is still the biggest life lesson that I'm grappling with, in every facet of my life, but especially professionally. You know, I was very lucky that with my first film, my first short, it did really well. I got international awards, got nominated for a BAFTA and an IFTA and blah. And I got a deal, I got a development deal and I got an agent. And I was like, yes, this is it. I've arrived. Right. I'll be making a feature in 2 years. I'll be, and I had this ladder that I was convinced I was going to climb. Hadn't really interrogated what the ladder looked like in detail, except that it was going to be film after award after accolade after, and of course, I mean, it took 4 or 5 years to get my first feature made after my first short, which felt like an absolute eternity.
And that was a long way from
And
home, right?
that
A
was a
long way
long
from
way from
home.
home, which was a tiny budget, £250,000 we made it for. No money, no support really at all, except for an exceptional bunch of actors, who again loved the script and came and did it. Operating outside the system to an extent, always feeling the outsider, looking in at the gatekeepers and the sort of the careers that were being nurtured, of other filmmakers. And yeah, I mean, it's a huge learning journey, and grappling with your own sense of ego and status and resentments and cynicism and going through that whole gamut of, why them and not me, or they're not so talented. What's the yeah. And sort of coming out the other side of it and realizing that, there are always going to be huge restrictions on state subsidized art, huge boxes that have to be ticked, and I'm not being conspiratorial or it's all political and this, that, and the other. I mean, it's not actually. Again, I was very, very cynical about execs and all this kind of stuff until you get to meet enough of them over the years and you realize, look, everybody's human. Most of them are coming from an incredibly well-meaning place. A lot of them are passionate about cinema and so on, but they're operating under massive restrictions as well. You can't
And they have a
talk
job to do.
to
They have their own boxes to tick,
them.
and they
Yeah,
have
they
their
do.
own.
That's it. That's right. That's right. And as you say, therefore, finding your real champions and allies along the journey, and whether they're for now or whether it'll come to fruition later, but finding that tribe that are absolutely for you, who believe, who love, who want to go on these journeys with you, and the kinds of films you're going to make and the kinds of stories you're going to tell. That's the key, really, I think. Or it has been for me, anyway.
Yeah, there's always the perception that there's this magic hand that will pluck somebody from obscurity and give them those opportunities. It's often your peers around you all working together.
It's your peers. It's look, and unfortunately, I mean, a little bit like Jared's character in Reawakening, who is still searching for his child 10 years on, as many parents would do, as I probably would, because you do occasionally hear that incredible story of, a child returning after 20 years locked in the basement. There are occasional miracle stories, and it's the same in our business. There are the miracle stories of, the kid who went to Sundance with a $20,000 movie and is suddenly offered the studio movie or whatever it is. But it's so vanishingly rare. But I think we're all kind of lulled into that belief that, and in a way, you kind of have to have that belief every single time. This is the one that's going to get, but it becomes slightly less important. It still is a motor and a fuel. It's more about, this is my life, actually, and what if I'm going to be out of action on a project for 2 to 5 to 10 years, whatever it, or that's going to be part of my world and part of my life, then it'd be better be something I give a shit about, for me anyway.
Today. Just a quick one about the film in general. Was it at all influenced by, I mean, there was a famous documentary a number of years ago called Imposter. I think there's some parallels, not in terms of the actual narrative strand, completely different worlds, but the idea of I suppose avatars really, replacing loved ones in some capacity. It was deeply uncomfortable to watch that idea or the potential of that idea. Did that play any part in it in any way, or was interesting.
Not massively. I had seen the film and I found it fascinating, but for me it was a very, very different story, because in that instance the implication was that the family were guilty, that the family accept an imposter because they might have had a guilty secret and they need to cover it up. I didn't rewatch it when I was preparing the film. I'd seen it when it came out, so that was what, 10 years ago already, something like that. And no, it wasn't in my mind when I was writing the story, although when I came to put my directing hat on, you know, I was looking at other cases and famous cases, and yes, when I was doing the writing I was looking at missing persons cases for details and so on, but no, that wasn't particularly the one that did come to mind after I'd sort of finished writing was the true case, which was made into a movie and then remade into a very bad movie, of the Return of Martin Guerre, which is based on a true medieval case. And again, very different sort of stories and worlds and what, you know, actually what happens. But there was some fascinating psychology that I felt had parallels. Not wanting to speak too deeply about it in case people haven't seen the film yet, and I don't want to, you know, spoil anything. But yeah, that was a touchstone in some ways, although again, I didn't go back and watch it, or, you know, partly because it wasn't really, these weren't really big influences, but there are echoes of, I think, what fascinated me about both stories, I guess, was just the psychology of the people. Is it a comment on that? It wasn't overtly for me, that I was less interested in. Because ultimately I think what the story is really, or what I hope it's really trying to do is I think if you want to talk about any real philosophical underpinnings, and this is what I only realize once I've written something and start to look at it with a more kind of directorial eye or storytelling eye, is that it is ultimately about what is it that matters to us in the face of loss? Mm-hmm. And what must we do to honor life? If loss is a part of life, you know, it does throw up those questions of, well, then what's the point if we're going to lose people that we love and so on and so forth, which all of us must face if we haven't already. And I think for me, the story ends on quite a hopeful note, because ultimately in the face of all that suffering and all that despair and all that loss and so on, there is only one thing to do to honor life, which is to embrace it and to love. And I think that ultimately is where the story brings us to. You may or may not agree with the way the characters handle their grief or handle their attempts at forging a new life. But I think what's very interesting to me is that I never at any point felt, and nor do I feel now, that either of them are wrong, or that either of them are foolish. I think both of them have absolute logic and right and on their side, both parents who take very, very different, who have very different responses to loss and to then the extraordinary return of somebody they thought gone. And I think that's what's fascinating, and why the film is quite compelling in its way, is that both of them are equally right in their own way.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a mediation on grief and the psychology of how people interpret that, you know, the statistics for couples.
Yeah.
I mean, even in terms of the statistics of couples who, you know, unfortunately lose children, have to, you know, the statistics of divorce in terms of couples,
well,
you know, is huge.
That's a key thing. That was something that was really an anchor for Juliet and Jared, and subsequently for talking about the film, is that actually, the reality is when couples lose a child, and especially this way, the majority of them can't remain together. There's too much separate guilt or whatever it may be that pulls them apart. Whereas the couple in this film have remained together. Now,
I think that's what's interesting about it. I think is that it's a study of a relationship grief, and obviously there's some undertones of and it's compelling. The word that you use there, I think, is important. Films like this are compelling. They're compelling watches. You want to figure it out. You want to watch it. It compels you to watch it, as
Yeah.
opposed to being, you know. And that within that, there's entertainment, and it's not all doom and gloom. There's some one or two kind of funny moments within it as well.
Yeah, and there's the motor of the plot, the thriller plot, which does keep the story quite a page turner in that sense. You want to know what's going to happen next on the level of plot. But I think it was the same question I was asking myself as I was writing. There is something very compelling in what are they going to do next? Okay, this has happened now. Holy shit, what would I do next? What's he going to do next? What's she going to do next? Oh my God, this has happened. Okay, so what would I do next? There is an absolute fascination of ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances. What are they going to do? Because you do identify quite powerfully with them, I think, both of them, actually. Maybe not equally throughout, but you're certainly, as I say, because both have complete right on their side, you feel very drawn in to the decisions that they're going to make, and you worry for them, or you want to cheer them on, or you want to stop them, or you want to but there is that. And I think it is because the psychology is both universal but also very unique. But
Do
yeah,
we
I think it's that. I think it's the psychology really is just really interesting and not often explored, on film.
I just wanted to ask you about artistic integrity.
Ooh.
This is a tricky one in terms of staying true to this, particularly right, like writer directors are a particular breed, as opposed to guns for hire, which are wonderful in what they do and the execution, etc. But the artistic integrity, when it's in direct conflict with kind of the commercial aspects and the obligations of things. In terms of distribution and how films are marketed now, and with the ever-changing landscape of how people view and consume media, like how hard is it, number one, to stick to your guns in terms of your own artistic integrity, particularly in a world where everything is such results-driven and stats and numbers now. Particularly in and around kind of social media, where it's all about hits and that type of thing, and how we consume media, and how there's no clear idea of what is successful and what's not anymore, in terms of returns.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you've nailed it in that it is such a rapidly and ever-changing marketplace that, in a way, of course, you do have to pay attention to certain elements of it, but in a way, it kind of is meaningless because, yeah, what do I mean by that? I think, look, I'm putting together my next movie now, which is by if I listened to the market, should never see the light of day. It's not what the market's currently looking for. It's really hard to sell. It's slightly darker subject matter and so on and so forth. But much like Reawakening, it's an effing brilliant script. Anybody who's read it thinks it's superb. It's a brilliant story. It keeps you hooked. And it's been lucky enough to attract a couple of allies who want to get it made, who are seasoned enough, who are also robust enough to go, yeah, the marketplace is always shit. And they're always going to say that, and so on. And you've got to, I think it goes back to that first question. You've got to be very honest with yourself about what it is you want to do, what matters to you, why, what are you in this for? And adjust your expectations accordingly. Reawakening was never going to be a multiplex 20 screenings a day popcorn munching movie. That's not what it was ever going to be. And therefore, there would have been no point going to, sales agents or distributors who market and sell those kinds of movies. So you have to, you set your expectations. Now, if it exceeds your expectations, fantastic. But you have to be very realistic about what it is you're trying to do, who it's for. I was very clear about who my target audience was, and it wasn't, the 15 to 20-year-olds who just want to watch an action movie. Do you know what I mean? And then, look, then you are up against the forces of trying to make your film visible in an incredibly oversaturated market, in a highly competitive market, in an incredibly expensive market. You know, the cost of trying to get any sort of advertising is phenomenal. Yeah, you can't pretend those forces aren't there, but I think in terms of your question about integrity, I think that in a way that's kind of the easiest one, because if you're very clear about the kind of film you're making, then you're going to be looking to work with the kind of people who support the kind of film you're making, who can sell the kind of film you're making, even if it's not necessarily globally to every big, you know, and your expectations are sort of informed that way, you know. Still going to be a fight to get any sort of visibility for you, and you're going to, you know, but at least your expectations are clear, and you're going into it relatively clear-eyed.
Yeah, it's never not a fight, is it?
No, never. And it's a fight even if you're lucky enough to get greenlit, and it's a fight at every stage. I mean, everything. I think that's why certainly temperaments like mine are drawn to it, because it's a microcosm of life all the time, just in very intense form, you know, crises and catastrophes and triumphs and problem solving, you know, and effectively you're spending your entire time finding solutions to problems you didn't even know existed, you know, and that is in a way a microcosm of life, just in a much more intense, you know, time frame. You know, it's like that old adage that drama is life with the boring bits taken out. Well, filmmaking is that too. You know, it's a constant, just a never-ending series of challenges on every level, you know, that you're dealing with. Yeah,
Yeah, absolutely.
at every and any given point.
Yeah. Do you think your time in Ireland informed your outlook on storytelling or your filmmaking in general?
I know that my time in Ireland, and also, I mean, you know, I'm back and forth to Ireland all the time. I mean, Ireland is as much my home. My children have Irish passports. I'm over there all the time. Although, and really, I would spend more time there than in London at the moment. It's slightly more weighted to London, but that's also because my Irish husband works a lot more in the UK than he does in Ireland. So it's his fault. I blame him entirely. But no, I mean, Ireland is an enormously formative part of my life. I mean, as I say, I was there a solid 15 years, you know, my entire sort of from adulthood onwards, I was there. I have family there now, I have roots there now. I fell in love with it. I absolutely fell in love with it because the storytelling is so much a part of daily life. Everything's a story and everyone's a storyteller, from your taxi driver to your, you know. It was so different to what I'd experienced growing up. It was such a different, more open, more bohemian culture, certainly when I arrived. I can't speak to it in the day-to-day now, but certainly that was it. That had a huge impact. In terms of filmmaking, I wouldn't be so definitive about, because you know the Irish industry has only really flourished on a much bigger scale relatively recently. You know, of course there were some key Irish filmmakers that I'd admired and I'd seen their films, but no, I mean my influences, I think, are sort of not nation specific, really. You know, they're quite a broad span of time periods and nationalities, I suppose.
And sure they, and so they should be. Just about like again, this podcast will be listened to, I'm sure, very late at night by people who would have very similar ideas about filmmaking, you know.
So you're going to, with any luck, if you're living well, you're going to evolve as a storyteller. You're going to get better if you keep practicing, if you keep, as I say, living well and making sure you have a life outside the bubble of the business, which is something I didn't do for a very, very long time. And am so grateful that I've done now, because ironically, since really committing to life, my career has blossomed. Very weird, isn't it? When I had all the time in the world and no responsibilities,
Yeah, you think you
it didn't
have
go so.
all the time in the world, huh? Do you think children help with that in terms
Yeah,
of
massively,
focusing?
massively. I was terrified before having my daughter, my first child, because I really, there is that school of thought, the pram in the hall is the enemy of art. If you're going to be a true artist, you have to commit your heart, soul, and every waking moment to it. And there was a part of me that really feared that that was true, and that I was going to, diminish my talent, or my what talent I had, or that I was now going to not commit as hard. But I've actually found the complete reverse to be true, that my work has only been so enormously enriched by having a real life, by living, by being a full human being, by committing to things that are far more important than, a Screen International headline. That, as I say, it's only really by stepping into life that all of that side of my life has flourished.
That's really beautiful. Where and how can people see Reawakening now?
Well, as of a few days ago, it is now
Just so
available
happens.
to, yeah, it just so happens that it is now just available to rent or buy digitally. So from all major sort of platforms, iTunes, Apple, Sky, Virgin, E, I don't know, there's a big list. If you just type Reawakening Watch online, YouTube, there'll be all sorts of platforms. We await further news from our distributors about other platforms that are coming, but it's only just come out digitally. So yes, please do rent it, buy it, and have a watch, because I do think the actors are absolutely magnificent in it. So if
They
nothing
are.
else.
It's a wonderful character study. I would implore people to give it a shot. Not in the sense that it needs it, but in the best possible way. It is a film that, students of film should watch and study. It's a film that will live, a lot longer than its cinema release. It will, not that it needs to find an audience, but in the best possible way, it will become part of the cinematic landscape, like all good films do over time. So give it a
Well,
watch.
thank you, Paul. From your lips to God's ears, as they say. I hope so. That's the hope. And you know what, actually, talking, even practically talking as we were earlier, you cannot underestimate the power of word of mouth for a film like this. It does need that. It needs people, one of you listening to go off and watch it, and if you're moved by it, or like it, to recommend it to your parents, recommend it to a mate, and that is the way films like this can grow.
Absolutely. I can't over you can't overestimate that type of word of mouth. I mean, some of my earliest memories were literally being sent off to collect videotapes amongst my family, movies like
And also great movies, they stay with you. They become part of your inner life. I mean, it's what we love about art, about the books, the music, the movies that have just become part of your, the fabric of your world, your imaginary world. But actually, they do form part of your world. They have informed the way I see the world and what resonates with me, and to be honest, in a market which is so oversaturated, it's incredibly rare that a new movie does that for me anymore. I'm lucky if there's maybe one or two every couple of years that I go, oh yeah, that's in me now. That's part of my furniture that I want to come back to. Maybe not immediately, but that's a story that stays with me. So yeah.
Especially at a time when, the swapping of like one of the great joys when we were younger was the passing on of a book. Passing
That's
on
right.
of a videotape, a DVD, check this
Yeah.
out,
Yeah.
this LP, this album,
It's the great loss. It's the great loss. I mean, obviously, living in Dublin, you must have been as familiar as I was with the laser stores.
Oh yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, I lived in there for years. I mean, I literally lived in there. And that is I think, such an untalked about loss, the loss of libraries, which I don't know, we're getting big cuts here in the UK, lots of bookstores, DVD stores, music stores, because the great joy was going in looking for one thing and finding 15 others and
Oh, yeah.
taking a chance and just seeing the physical things in front of you.
Yeah, I mean, I miss that. I mean, I get such a kick out of watching the Criterion Collection videos, and because of that, because I miss that.
I
I
miss
miss
that.
the idea.
I miss that. Our local corner store used to have a video collection when I was about eight, 7 or 8, and I would be compelled. I'd be reading all the backs of the horrors. I was so captivated by the movies I wasn't allowed to watch, and there is, my kids don't have that. It's not the same reading a tiny little blurb on Netflix that's going to just show you the algorithm of stuff you've seen before. There's not, they don't have that opportunity to browse, to really browse and go, "Ooh, I love the cover of that one. What's that about?"
I mean, it does exist. I mean, the IFI still have a library, a DVD library. But yeah, I mean, we should bring back, there should be at
Listen,
least.
I will donate to bring back Laser. Laser were absolutely fantastic. I would, and I bought so much when they were closing down. I was devastated. I bought so much in their closing down sale. And I bought loads of VHSs as well, which was idiotic. But then I have kept a rickety old VHS machine just in case someone one day wants to watch a video. But they just take up a lot of space in my house now.
Yeah,
But yeah,
but
I was really gutted.
it's exactly that. I mean, and this is the thing about those environments. There's stuff that you will never find online, never, that only exists in physical media.
Yeah, and stuff you didn't even know you wanted to watch, and probably you didn't, but actually you give it a go anyway.
You go in for two, come out with six.
Yeah.
Can you talk about any upcoming projects?
Yes, in a tentative way, I've just been commissioned to adapt quite a big novel as writer and director, so that's early stages, so I'm working on that now. It is quite interesting to be
Congratulations.
back. Thank you, to be back at the desk after having been in production and then doing the rounds with a movie, so that's been an interesting little transition back to sitting down for a few hours a day, and then putting together the next movie. So there's some finance attached. We're casting at the moment, and it's a bigger budget than Reawakening, quite substantially bigger. So it's a big kind of, it's a bigger beast. So it's there's more parts to put together and more people that have to come on board to help do that. So that's, but that's motoring along. So there we are. The hope would be, if we're really blessed by the gods of film, that we could be shooting it very late summer next year, but more likely, I suspect it'll be spring the following year.
Okay, excellent. Something to look forward to. Six.
Yeah, that's
Listen,
right.
thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, I think people will get a lot out of this. We'll also obviously share the film and its digital release all around our network and our Facebook group. And
Thank you.
for hopefully not the last time, thanks so much and have a great day and enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Thank you, Paul. You too. Thanks a million.
Okay, take care. Bye bye.
Bye-bye.
So, hello everybody. Welcome back to F&I Rap Chat. I'm your host for today, Mark Monks, and today I'm joined by writer, director, and actor Mark Ager, and actor and writer and producer Siobhan Eileen, is it Eileen?
Ashlyn,
Ashlyn, sorry, apologies.
She's fine.
Today we're going to be discussing your brand new film, Blurred Lines. Before I get into it, I will say I did love it. I thought it was a beautiful, beautiful film. I thought it was fantastic. It's a really kind of interesting look at not only like different relationships, but also kind of discussing heavy themes like SA and also addiction as well, mm-hmm. and that sort of stuff. There's so many themes being put into it, and it's been doing really well as well. So congratulations on all the laurels and all the awards. Yeah, let's get straight into it. So please tell us just a little bit about the film itself.
So it is, we covered the topic of consent a lot, but I suppose through writing it, we realised how many different forms of consent there were. So we originally started talking about SA, and then we realised how many different levels of consent there are within a friendship group. So we had peer pressure, we had consent within an actual relationship, consent within a friendship group, I suppose being in a relationship that one person might want more than the other person wants. And so we centered around six friends on New Year's Eve. Mm-hmm. And at the party, a drink gets spiked, and all of these built up tensions and inner turmoils that have been going on come to the forefront, and all hell breaks loose, basically.
And it's funny when you start, as Siobhan is just pointing out there, when you start like writing about a certain theme, then things just kind of fall into place. Mm. That's also about consent. That is just to the simple part that in the movie a character takes a group photo and one of the characters isn't ready for it. Yeah. And that was just a little throwaway thing of, you know, getting something that we needed for another part. But then we're looking into it, like, there's another form of consent.
Yeah, yeah.
A guy giving a proposal and stuff, that's another form. And like everything we're doing, we're like, are we geniuses? Or is this literally just the theme that's coming into play more and more, especially with, you know, our age group? And so much of it has become like normalized that you can peer pressure friends into drinking, you can peer pressure anyone into doing anything as long as you try make it seem that they're being uncool doing so. And I think it kind of wrote itself in that way, you know.
Well, that's the thing, like when you were mentioning like your age group and that sort of stuff, like to me, when I was, as I was watching it, I immediately got kind of like Jonathan Larson kind of vibes, kind of, you know, the real theater kid. It's like, I'm 29, what's gonna happen? Like, I can't do, like, you know, I haven't done this, I haven't done that, I need to do this, that sort of stuff. Do you know,
big inspiration. I'm 30 in like a month and I'm like, oh god.
You know, like 39, he just repeating in my head, I'm just like, oh. But you know, that sort of thing, like, and that adds an extra layer of anxiety and isolation, and especially for like someone like your character, Chris, where she's in the creative arts and doesn't really know what she wants to do yet. Like she has aspirations, but she doesn't really know how to get there, and she feels trapped and that sort of stuff, you know. It, and with that level of kind of like layeredness with the anxiety and isolation, and then on top of that you have the sort of consensual stuff and the essay sort of stuff, it really kind of creates this